From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an update from the Michigan Radio newsroom on hospital capacity throughout the state.
She said, "I don't know why I keep coming to work. I'm not helping any of these people."
We'll hear how facilities all over Michigan are dealing with fewer available beds and more burnout. Also, we're having a conversation with Shika Dalmia about a deflating election cycle for libertarians.
The culture wars have become a big mobilizing thing for libertarians, and you know, and they take more of the right side in the culture war than the left.
And we check in with movie theaters about the ongoing impact of COVID.
It is a very tough time for us, for commercial movie theaters, for performing arts venues of all kinds, whether they're profit or nonprofit.
Many are embracing streaming over the short term, but the long-term picture is less clear. Those stories are coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're going to speak with columnist Shika Dalmia about the way the libertarian movement may turn next. 4 years of Donald Trump have deeply shaken the movement's alliance with Republicans. That's coming up later in the show, but first, after weeks of a steep climb, the number of people hospitalized for COVID has started to level out a bit in parts of Michigan. Hospital leaders in West Michigan say that gives them a modicum of hope that maybe people are starting to be more careful about distancing and mask wearing. But as Dustin Dwyer is here to tell us, the picture across the state is complicated. Hi, Dustin.
Hello, April.
So what's the situation in hospital capacity where you are?
Well, out here, across the state, really, in general, it is not good. But as you said, it is a little complicated depending on where you look. So I live in Grand Rapids, and in West Michigan, just in the past week, we have seen the numbers start to flatten out and even in certain hospital systems start to decline. That is the number of people hospitalized with the virus. But in Southeast Michigan, the numbers continue to climb pretty rapidly, especially in Macomb County, where numbers are rising very fast.
Geographically, is there anything overall we can say about where things are just bad and where they're becoming incredibly serious?
Yeah, because there's no place that's really good, but and where things are bad versus terrible, it changes almost day to day. We've been hearing in the past few weeks about how bad things had gotten, say, in the Western Upper Peninsula. I had been hearing about how bad things were in Battle Creek. The hospitals there had gotten full. Also, Muskegon has been a place, particularly Mercy Health Hospital in Muskegon, had been a place where things were really bad, and we kept hearing things get worse and worse and worse in Grand Rapids, although they are not getting worse at the same rate anymore in West Michigan, at least in the past week. But we see other places such as Saginaw and north of Saginaw, hospitals are really filling up quickly. And in Macomb County, more and more people are showing up at the hospital. In Macomb County's test positivity rate, that is the percentage of people who take the test and the test comes back positive, that is continuing to rise in Macomb County, which suggests that the hospitalizations will get worse there as well.
What are administrators telling you about how this affects their care, what they can do for patients that might have other health conditions who also need hospitalization right now?
Well, they're very careful about how they talk about this, because if you just look at the data from the state, you will see that there are six hospitals in Michigan that are listed right now at 100% capacity, and there's more than 20 hospitals that are over 90% capacity right now. But hospital administrators saw in the spring that when people thought that hospitals weren't safe, when they thought they might get sick at hospitals, people started putting off going to the hospital for things that really were medical emergencies, and that caused more problems. That caused more people to get sick and maybe even caused more people to die. So even as we see hospitals fill up, hospital administrators are really still sending the message, hey, you still need to come to the hospital if you have a problem. And that came up today in Berrien County, where the Berrien County Health Department held an update. And Dr. Lauren Hamill, who's president of Spectrum Health Lakeland, located in Berrien County, talked about this. Now, the hospital he leads, Spectrum Health Lakeland, is listed at 100% capacity right now. But here's what he had to say about it.
We are completely committed to take care of the heart attacks and the strokes and the injuries that occur within Berrien County. So you can count, we're doing everything we can to be there for you if a medical need arises.
And the other thing that Dr. Hamill said in that briefing is that even though the state shows them at 100% capacity, they are expanding and adding more beds specifically for COVID patients. And that's where things get a little weird with the state data. A hospital may show that it has space, but the reality is they've already expanded their capacity a few times, or one hospital may show they're at 100% capacity and they still have the ability to add beds.
I guess that'll do for a bright spot. Is there anything else that you've heard that's giving doctors hope right now?
Well, the hope, I mean, is that the latest order from MDHHS, which has now been in effect for more than 2.5 weeks, did change behaviors and possibly started to bend the curve of hospitalizations and positive tests. Particularly, you can see that in West Michigan, where in Spectrum Health, in Grand Rapids especially, there actually has been a decline in the number of people showing up at the hospital. And they don't know exactly why that is yet, and they expect it may reverse and start to get bad again. But there is hope that the measures people are taking are having an effect. I talked yesterday to Dr. Joshua Koistra, who's the chief medical officer of Spectrum Health.
I would say that it's still particularly bad and highly concerning. The fact that we've gone from 360 inpatients to 300 patients is maybe a welcome reprieve. But we are still preparing for higher numbers yet and are realistically expecting that.
And the real unknown right now is what will happen from the holidays. Did people really stay home and stay separated over Thanksgiving, or were there gatherings that will then lead to more positive cases and lead to more people showing up in hospitals?
I know you and some other reporters from Michigan Radio have been talking to a lot of healthcare workers. How are they doing right now?
A lot of them are really struggling. And I've talked to a few nurses at some of these hospitals that have seen a decline in patients. And that doesn't necessarily mean that things have gotten better for these workers. For one thing, just because there's been an overall decline in the number of COVID patients at the hospital doesn't mean that the ICUs are any less full. And that's the case for Spectrum Health in Grand Rapids. Their ICUs are still, the ICU numbers are still as high as they were a week ago. The other thing is that more and more healthcare workers themselves are getting sick. So while there may be fewer patients, there may also be fewer people to take care of those patients. So it's really stressful right now. It is not necessarily better yet. I talked to one nurse who works in an ICU in Muskegon, one of the hardest hit hospitals, and she just told me that everyone is just really stressed.
We have learned a lot. I'm thankful for that. We have learned a lot. You know, we are trying new treatments, but there are still days that we lose. I had a doctor say to me the other day, one of our pulmonologists, she said, "I don't know why I keep coming to work. I'm not helping any of these people." She's trying. She is trying so hard. But it's demoralizing, you know? It's just, you feel helpless against it.
So I talked to Molly Nixon maybe a few weeks ago, and, you know, the numbers at that hospital have gotten better, but another nurse that I talked to there, who I just messaged with the other day, I said, you know, is it better for you? And she said, it's a little better, but it's still hell.
Dustin, what happens after hospitals get to the point where they've maxed out? You mentioned that some of them are expanding. Is this taking the form of field hospitals or some other kind of temporary care?
The idea of field hospitals is something that's been, the hospital leaders have said they've wanted to avoid that for a couple of reasons. One is that in the spring, when that happened, say in Detroit, they opened a field hospital at the TCF Center, and then there just weren't that many people who used it. And then the other is that they're not sure they have the people to staff it, even if they opened a large field hospital. You know, there's still a shortage of nurses, so who would take care of those people? So for now, basically what they've been doing is just reconfiguring floors within hospitals. And I think that's what they'll continue to do for some time, but we don't know. If this does get a lot worse, that is something we may see.
Can you give us a sense of, I mean, obviously a lot of people have their eyes on those numbers from Thanksgiving weekend, and it's hard to get an anecdotal bead on how many people in Michigan were gathering with family, but wow, the airports just seemed really full. How soon are medical professionals thinking that we might know what actually happened and whether that surge is really here?
Well, there's sort of a math that goes with it. If you they know about how long it is for symptoms to start to show. If you got an infection, if you were exposed on Thanksgiving, it might be 5 days before you show any symptoms, and then it might be a couple days after that before you decide to show up at the hospital. So they're really thinking within the next week, they might find out more people will decide to get tested if they do get symptoms. And then in the weeks after that, they'll see if more people end up showing up at hospitals. But I do think that we're going to see it different depending on the region. Like right now in Kent County, the percent positivity rate for tests had dipped below 15%, or is still below 15%. In Macomb County, just in the past day, the test positivity rate was above 23%. So in Macomb County, you may already be seeing that surge, and it may even go up from there. So you'll have to just look at each individual community to see where things are headed.
One last thing, Dustin. A lot of people are pinning a lot of hopes on the vaccines that are nearing the regulatory approval stage of the research process. What are the medical professionals saying about what kind of bailout a vaccine could provide?
Well, that came up today again in the Berrien County update with Dr. Lauren Hamill, and he said that, first off, they're not going to get that many doses of the vaccine right off the bat. He said Spectrum Health had initially been hoping to get up to 30,000 doses of the vaccine just in the first batch, which hopefully will arrive before the end of the year. He now says that they're expecting to have only 900 doses in that first batch, and so it will not be widely available to people, certainly not before the end of the year. And depending on how production looks, depending on how it gets rolled out, it could be months before you could get your vaccine. So they're really just still leaning on the basics that they've been saying really since the summer, social distancing, limit indoor gatherings, if not eliminate them completely, wear your mask all the time, and wash your hands.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. Dustin, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, April.
One quick postscript here. Dustin got an update from the nurse that we just heard from, Molly Nixon. She says that the trauma of COVID has gotten to be too much for her. She's leaving her job at the hospital after next week. We'll talk to one theater manager about cinema surviving COVID next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When the COVID-19 pandemic first hit Michigan, movie theaters all across the state had to close. And after months of dark screens, they did enjoy a brief period of reopening in early October. Now a second surge has shuttered them again. Just like in the restaurant industry, some movie theater owners are deeply frustrated. They say they're going to need more support to help their businesses get through this new wave of restrictions. How do these closures impact a nonprofit arts film organization? Joining us now is Russ Collins. He's the executive director and CEO of the Michigan Theater Foundation. You may know them as the organization that runs the Michigan and State Theaters in Ann Arbor. Russ Collins, welcome to Stateside.
It is a pleasure to be with you.
So how long were the Michigan and the state closed after the virus first arrived?
Well, we were closed from the middle of March to early October, and then we were open for about 5 weeks, and then the state required that we close down, and we're currently closed, and we'll probably stay closed for several more weeks.
What a period of whiplash this must be for everybody on staff and everybody who loves to come and watch. Could you tell us about the impact that the closures had on you?
Sure. Well, the Michigan Theater does cinema and performing arts, and so we're the home of many University of Michigan organizations who perform on stage and the local symphony and touring acts of all different kinds. So all of those productions went away. In terms of movies, the state theater is devoted singularly to cinema, and the Michigan does large-scale cinema, and then we also have a 200-seat screening room. So our budget was more than halved, and this year we're expecting our budget to be below that significantly. So we're going to be about one-third the size of business that we were before COVID hit. We expect to return to where we were before COVID at some point in time, but it's going to be a difficult path, I think, as we go through the next few months and even a year or two after the vaccine is widely implemented.
Russ, I don't want to take this any place you don't want to go, but you sound shockingly calm for somebody who's facing down an economic crisis like this.
Well, it certainly is a crisis for sure. And as a nonprofit cultural organization, we have a really tremendous resource in terms of our donors and members. And they have been continuing to support us during this close down. One of the nice things about being a community institution is that people really feel ownership of the place. And so they want us to survive.
I was surprised to see how relatively quickly many art house and nonprofit theaters started offering some virtual programming and streaming options. Was this a thing at all before the pandemic for the Michigan and the state?
It was not. The most difficult thing, actually, is securing the rights to stream cinema, because it's really not set up for individual theaters to stream it. It's set up for large studios and streaming services to stream cinema and television programs, but not individual theaters. So smaller distributors turned to the theaters. So it was a combination of people who had the rights to the movies coming to art house cinemas and other theaters as well, and allowing their films to be streamed, and then the theaters implementing the technology so that they could put those into people's homes.
What do you think changed distributors' thinking about working with streaming in this way?
Well, the chain from your local cinema to filmmakers is connected. If theaters aren't showing movies, distributors aren't distributing movies, and filmmakers don't have outlets for their films. And one of the things that we found in the streaming world, theaters are a channel, one channel that you can watch movies on. And the more convenient channel to watch it on is a screen in your home. But really, theaters are providing a night out. For 50, 60 years, you've been able to have multiple choices in your home to watch a movie or a television show or just not leave your house. So theaters have survived not because there aren't other ways to see a movie, but because they're a really nice way to get out of the house, to be with friends. I actually call this the campfire desire. Human beings, prehistory, gathered together to hear their elders tell stories about their community, about their tribe, about their geographical area, their history, and their legends. And so sitting around as a community, experiencing a story together, is really what going to a theater to see a movie is about. That's one of the key drivers for going out to movies, which is why movies will survive after COVID as well.
Which brings us to 2020 and the year when going out just wasn't a thing anymore. Could you talk about how you decided to structure the pay model? Could you just explain a little bit about, you know, what the streaming options are that you decided to go with and how they work?
Well, most of the streaming options are actually controlled by the distributors. So the typical way that a movie is presented when people come to the theater and it's projected on the screen is we collect the ticket price and then we send it to the distributors. With the majority of the models that are out there, the distributor actually provides a geo-tagging for a theater, and they collect the money from the viewers, and then they send us a check. So it's a little bit of a reverse. So for many of the films, you have to go through each individual distributor's technology and paywall to get to the film. but they do share the revenue with us because we'll be promoting it. However, we also have our own streaming capability. So there are special programs that we do, trivia programs, some silent films with live music, some locally made films where we have our own paywall and our own streaming capability that allows us to do that.
My guest today is Russ Collins. He's the executive director and CEO of the Michigan Theater Foundation. It runs the Michigan and State Theaters in Ann Arbor. Russ, is the virtual programming even close to comparable to what the theaters usually bring in terms of ticket receipts?
Not at all. And that's been true nationwide. The Michigan Theater runs a national organization called the Art House Convergence. So we are in contact with hundreds of our colleagues all over North America. And there are a few theaters that have had some success doing it, but most theaters are not seeing people responding very strongly to their local programming. And it's not because of the quality of the programming. The quality of the programming is really excellent. Not that you're going to like every film that's streamed on the theater, but that's true if you just go to a movie in a theater or turn on Netflix and pick a show. They may be very good, but it doesn't mean that it particularly is your cup of tea. And it also just emphasizes the fact that the reason that movies are shown at movie theaters is because human beings are social creatures, and many of us like to go out to the movies. We like to get out of the house. We want to avoid the convenience of sitting on the couch and watching a small screen, because even a big screen TV in a house is still a small screen compared to a movie theater. And so it's that sitting in the darkened room full of your fellow community members, some of them you know, some of them you don't, but it is that social experience of getting out, you know, going to the restaurant, having a burger, and then going to the movie, and then maybe going back to the restaurant or a different bar or something and talking about the movies with your friends and neighbors.
Russ, what kind of feedback did you hear from theater patrons when you did reopen?
The people that came were very, very grateful and enjoyed their time in the theaters. The audiences were very small, partially because attendance was only 20% of what a theater's capacity was,
right?
An individual cinema screening room capacity was. So except for the Michigan Theater, but it's a very big theater. It has 1,600 seats. So even if you have 100 people in there, people are very, very spread out. So the feeling was a little bit sparse. But they were grateful that we were open. But there's a great deal of anxiety. It was a little frustrating on our part because the way that we implemented, we had people wear masks the entire time that they were in the theater because it, you know, it is an indoor space. And so wearing a mask is a very good thing to do in an indoor space. Consequently, we didn't sell concessions, which I know is a very important part of movie theater going for the customers and for the theaters.
Of course.
Yeah. Safety was the number one thing. It is a difficult challenge, but again, with community support, we've been able to meet that challenge to this point.
So we're in this period now in which movie theaters, along with restaurants, are shuttered for in-person service. You know, you can't bring people into the theaters for this period of 3 weeks. Are you preparing yourself for the possibility that there may be a longer closure?
Yes, we are. We are preparing ourselves for that. The infection rates are very, very high. Fortunately, treatment is much, much better than it was early in the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So your chances of survival are very high. I do take a little bit of hope from the fact that after the flu pandemic of 1918, it was followed by the 1920s, which is known as the Roaring Twenties. And many people are saying that part of the reason that the 20s roared was because the flu pandemic was such a negative impact that people really wanted to celebrate community and celebrate life and celebrate the fact that the world can be a happy place after being such a sad place for a long period of time.
Russ Collins, from your lips to God's ears, we're looking forward to a time when folks can visit theaters in a more unrestrained manner again. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you, April. We'll see you at the movies someday.
Russ Collins is the executive director and CEO of the Michigan Theater Foundation. Our friends at Cheers to Michigan have found that there's a lot to a name, especially if it's the wrong name. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and mixologist Tammy Coxon gin up their explanation for us today.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham, and we're here to take another look at some Michigan products and make some cocktails. Boy, you must need a lot of gin because you've got two bottles of gin sitting there.
Well, I have an exciting experiment for us today, Lester. You may remember a few weeks ago, I busted out this old, old bottle of Grand Traverse rye that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a friend of mine has, some friends of his moved out of town and they left behind some interesting products. And one of those is this.
Well, that is an old bottle because it's one of those really simple, look like a inkjet printer actually made that label.
And what does it say?
It says gin batch number 4.
Batch number 4. And the small print underneath says Valentine Distilling Company.
Oh, really?
Yes. So I'm really excited. I have not tasted these. I'm going to taste them live with you. We have the current bottling of Liberator Gin mm-hmm. from Valentine Distilling Company.
I'm more familiar with that.
Yeah. That we're going to taste. And then we're going to compare and see what the heck Batch 4 tasted like. No idea how old it is, but I'm really excited.
I mean, they were one of the early distillers.
They were very, very early.
So which one is this one?
So the first one we're going to taste is the regular one, so we can sort of see what it tastes like now. Nice aroma. Very classic London Dry style.
Yep.
Oh, I really like that.
It's nice.
Got a little cardamom to it. It's sweet. Not sweet, sweet. Like, it's not sweetened, but it's easy to drink. It's smooth. I really like that.
Yep. That's a good one. I agree.
Yeah. Maybe there's some cardamom in there. I don't know. I love cardamom.
Yeah, there's a little more complex than, let's say, like beef eaters.
Yeah. But also very straightforward and would work in those kinds of cocktails. Okay. So this next one, this is batch number 4. Definitely less aroma for me. You have the better glass, so I don't know if you can smell more than I can.
Not much.
It's not quite as smooth. Some of the same botanicals are definitely there.
That cardamom is still in there.
Is still in there for sure.
But it doesn't have as much of the juniper, it doesn't seem like, to me.
I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. It's got like a little bit of a kind of a bitter botanical, which some of this could just be bottle age, right? You know, spirits like this, they don't go bad in like they're going to make you sick kind of way. But over a long period of time, the flavors of any botanical influenced spirit are going to change. So we cannot judge them by their past, but I wouldn't turn down a drink
that's nice.
That at all. It's really nice. And you can kind of see the through line. Well, maybe somebody from Valentine will get in touch and tell us
just how old this bottle is.
How old batch number 4 is, because I'm really curious. But all right, well, thanks for that experiment.
So which one, I assume you used the new one in this cocktail? What is this cocktail?
I did, because I wanted anybody who wanted to mix this at home to have the same kind of flavor experience we did. So this drink, today I'm going to call the Autumn Sage. If it were in August, I'd be calling it the Summer Sage. If it were the middle of winter, I might call it the Winter Sage.
So this works just about any time.
Its real name is the Marquee Cocktail, which just isn't a very good name from a sounding appealing perspective. The very first time I ever did a cocktail event was at the Ravens Club. We talk about this in our book, Cheers to Michigan, right? Where I was doing a guest bartending event at the Ravens Club. And mm-hmm. when I was testing for that event, I tested this as one of my cocktails, and I had a bunch of, you know, had a menu of drinks for people to choose from and to see what would people order. At the end of the night, no one had ordered this one. And I was like, what's going on? So I made one and I passed around. All my friends sampled it. And they're like, well, this is really good. I changed the name to Summer Sage. And it was the second best-selling drink on the menu when I was live at the Ravens Club. Anyway, so names matter. And the Autumn Sage is a lovely, refreshing, bright kind of cocktail that has some hints of fall flavor in there.
Okay. You've got the gin. I see a bottle of Aperol. How do you put this all together?
I'm starting with 1.5 ounces of the Liberator Gin from Valentine, and then 3/4 ounce Aperol. So this is one of those aperitivos from Italy. A little bit bitter, mostly sweet, kind of wakes up your stomach. This would be a good pre-dinner drink. 3/4 ounce of the lemon juice, 1/4 ounce of simple syrup, a tiny little pinch of salt. The bitterness in the Aperol is going to get countered nicely with the salt, and it just kind of adds a savory quality. And then a couple leaves of sage, great thing about this drink, you don't even need to muddle the sage in there. You just shake it up and the ice does all the work.
Well, it looks beautiful. And you've got a little bit of those sage bits in there. That's kind of nice. I like that, actually.
Right. I'm sure at a bar, they would have double strained this through a tea strainer so that it would look nicer for you.
Oh, I kind of like it this way.
But I kind of like the little floaty bits too. And I'm also going to garnish this with a sage leaf. So whenever you garnish with a single leaf that I'm going to float on top here, I'm going to put that in my hand and I'm going to smack it, and that's going to wake up the aroma, since that kind of garnish is all about smelling the sage as soon as you bring it to your nose.
Well, let's give it a taste.
All right.
So it's got this deep kind of apricot color. It's a dark apricot.
It's really beautiful.
Wow. This is not what I thought it was going to be. Very nice. It's a really light, refreshing sort of drink.
Absolutely.
You could serve this in summer and it'd be perfect. Serve it in fall and winter too.
Exactly. Now you're understanding my point.
Exactly. That's very nice. Well, I wonder what that would taste like with the batch number 4 gin. It'd be a different character altogether.
It would be, but I found it to be a really versatile drink that will work with all sorts of different gins. So,
well, apparently popular at the Ravens Club at that point.
So. That's right, 9 years ago.
Just not marquee. All right, that's the Autumn Sage. Cheers.
Cheers.
Up next, Chika Dalmia talks about what might lie ahead for libertarians, including the Michigan politician who's been one of the movement's brightest stars.
Even though there are lots of libertarians and even conservatives, and I think liberals too, who are very impressed with Justin Amash, I'm not sure they are concentrated in a district from which he could win.
We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Writer Chika Dalmia was coming into prominence right around the same time America's libertarian movement was gaining national steam. Her columns, going back to a stint writing editorials for the Detroit News, were a brisk blend of sharp, witty prose, classic fiscal conservatism, and a broad-minded ethos on social issues. Her work appeared in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and for a long time at the libertarian website Reason.com, where she worked as a columnist and a senior analyst for 15 years. That relationship has ended rather abruptly. She was let go at Reason this week, an apparent casualty of her criticism of Donald Trump. At this crossroads for conservatives of all stripes, Republican and libertarian, we wanted to talk to Chika Dalmia about what may come next. Chika Dalmia, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
How do you describe libertarianism in this moment?
It's a difficult question, I suppose. Libertarianism, you know, traditionally has billed itself as neither of the right nor of the left, and in some ways both of the right and of the left. So, you know, the lazy description of libertarianism is it's socially liberal and fiscally conservative. So, you know, free markets on one hand, but then, you know, socially liberal policies on the other hand. But I think it is fair to say that the modern incarnation of the libertarian movement that we see today emerged during the heyday of the Cold War, you know, when socialism was the big threat that this country was facing. You know, this was the post-Barry Goldwater era. So it developed in some ways as a sort of effusionism with the right. And I think that has inflected libertarianism a whole lot, so that right now what you see is, I think it's sort of tilts a little bit more to the right than it does to the left. This doesn't mean that libertarianism, you know, abandons or turns a blind eye to many of the issues of the left. It doesn't. I mean, it's really good on, for instance, the impact of the war on drugs of, you know, to minorities and especially the black community. You know, it is at the forefront of championing a free movement of people, immigration. So it has issue set. It has an eclectic issue set, but I think fundamentally, you know, in a certain philosophical way, it takes more of an inspiration from the right, and that's reflected in how libertarians themselves have become polarized with the culture war issues. I think to me, that's where it's the it's the clearest. The culture wars have become a big mobilizing thing for libertarians, and they take more of the right side in the culture war than the left's.
As early as 2011,
you were writing to point out a certain anti-intellectual bent that was taking shape in the Republican Party and warning that it was going to be a problem. Is it possible to put a finger on the point at which a certain defensiveness about conservative intellectual tradition, as you put it, kind of hardened into an intellectual goofiness that led the Republican Party to part ways with academia and any number of newspapers and other news sources that might have otherwise been influences leading to some rigor?
Yeah. You know, that essay, so much has happened since I wrote that essay, right? And in some ways it was prescient, I suppose, and in some ways it was, you know, didn't see what was going to happen quite at the level that it did. But, you know, in that essay, I suggested that, you know, the moment when conservatives became intellectually defensive was when Dan Quayle was the vice president. And, you know, that very famous moment of his when he told a middle schooler how to spell potato and got it wrong. And the press, the mainstream media, you know, exploded into laughter and pillorying of Dan Quayle. And that made conservatives at that time extremely intellectually defensive. You know, they kind of circled the wagons around him and what have you. And then came Sarah Palin. And, you know, Sarah Palin was the vice presidential running mate of John McCain, who himself was, you know, very, very impressive, stellar guy, you know, both sort of like a statesman, right? I mean, an intellectual, but also a man of action. But then he picked Sarah Palin. And she got pilloried. Now, Sarah Palin had this very, you know, sort of folksy appeal to her. So, you know, and when she started getting pilloried, instead of running away from her, you know, lack of knowledge and her, you know, lack of sort of this intellectual bearings, she embraced them. I mean, Dan Quayle was defensive about, you know, what he had done. Sarah Palin kind of cashed in on, you know, for the want of a better word, her empty-headedness. And that, to me, was sort of an inflection point and paved the way for Donald Trump in many, many ways, because he just took what Sarah Palin was doing to a whole new level. But I think the other part of it, I mean, I do have to say, is that liberals have played a part in it, too. You know, intellectuals haven't really delivered to this country. I mean, they have all kinds of pretensions of, you know, knowing what they are doing and a certain kind of, you know, technocratic conceit, which actually Hayek also warned against, you know, that they know how to like sort of remake society top down. And, you know, Obama was in some way the epitome of it. He carried his intellect on his sleeve and he gave the country Obamacare, which at least in the first 5 years was made a complete mess of things. And I would argue even now, you know, took the country on a somewhat wrong path when it comes to healthcare. And that just left a very bad taste in the mouth of, you know, sort of the folksy, ordinary working class people who thought they were going to be helped by Obamacare, but were not. And I think that, too, has made them double down against the elites and, you know, the designs of the elites.
So when Donald Trump became the Republican Party's nominee in 2016, when you look at this guy who is sort of the apex of the anti-intellectual trend on the right, a reality TV star and total non-politician, what bothered you about him?
Oh, my God. Where to begin? You know, from my standpoint, you know, Donald Trump, his worst flaw was not that he was just so anti-intellectual, which he was. His worst flaw was from a libertarian standpoint. You know, you couldn't come up with a candidate who was more anti-libertarian, who was by nature an authoritarian, who by nature did not understand the institutions of, you know, liberal democracy. You know, he is a man who glorified state violence, right? I mean, he brought out the military in D.C. to clear out peaceful protesters so that he could have a photo op outside the church. I mean, this man was calling on his fans in his rallies to bash protesters. I mean, protesting is a time-honored tradition in this country. I mean, that's what this country is all about. And he was inviting his fans to beat up protesters. I mean, open call to violence. That is a complete no-no in for libertarians. So, you know, this open glorification of state violence and violence as such is what really, really spooked me about Donald Trump. And he was at it right till the end, you know, calling the press the enemy of the people, you know, belittling anybody who stood up to him. He purged every sensible person from the Republican Party who was not kowtowing to him. I mean, the list is kind of endless. He is just a nightmare for libertarians from a libertarian standpoint.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Shika Dalmia, a longtime writer and theorist in libertarian circles. You can find her work online at the website The Week. Shika, why do you think that more Republicans and maybe more libertarians didn't sound the alarm about Donald Trump?
So it's a good question. And my own feeling is that a libertarianism has got too caught up in the culture wars. Given the culture wars, I think too many libertarians or people who thought they were libertarians, I don't think they're real libertarians, for them, owning the liberals became everything. So, you know, so long as Trump was sticking it to, the Democratic or the liberal establishment, that's literally all they cared about. They were very fed up with the forces of political correctness. And on that part, you know, with some justice, they're extremely upset with what's going on in university campuses, you know, where they see that there's a regime of censorship. You know, the smallest thing you say can be used against you. And so there had been a lot of pent up resentment against that culture of censorious culture of liberalism, you know. And so the fact that Trump came and kind of was fearless in sticking his finger in the eye of this liberal orthodoxy just really excited them. They felt he was going to open up this space for them to say what they want to say that had been closing. So I think that was like a huge part of Donald Trump's appeal. And so it was fine with them, you know, that he burns down the system, burns down all the values that they have been espousing so long as he was just sticking it to their political enemies.
We'd be remiss if we were talking about this libertarian post-Trump moment if we didn't note what happened with Justin Amash over the past couple of years. He eclipsed many other national figures as a standard bearer for libertarian ideals. But at the same time, he parted with the Republican Party over Donald Trump's impeachment and ultimately stepped away from his congressional seat as he was pondering a run for president, something that he ultimately decided not to pursue. Do you think that Justin Amash might have a future in terms of harnessing some of the disaffectation that libertarians and some Republicans are feeling in this moment?
You know, politically, electorally, I don't know, because even though there are lots of libertarians and even conservatives, and I think liberals too, who are very impressed with Justin Amash, I'm not sure they are concentrated in a district from which he could win, right? So I'm not sure. I think that's why he's decided to step out of politics. It's not clear he can actually win again. The bigger issue is if he can harness his brand of libertarian conservatism in some other political fashion. He could be, if he wanted to, be a sort of a new intellectual godfather of a new kind of like a libertarian movement post-Trump that is more interested in shoring up the institutions of checks and balances that this country relies on to keep state power and autocracy in check. You know, he was fearless in some ways in going after Trump. I mean, at least more fearless than any other Republican. You know, he was sticking up for all the agencies that were trying to control public corruption. You know, the fact that Donald Trump had his children who were running his businesses on his staff in the White House. I mean, Amash was throwing shade on all of that. So I think he understands how the institutions of this country are supposed to work and the damage that Donald Trump's presidency has done to them. And he has a voice. I mean, he's a very, very, you know, he has the ability to kind of cut to the chase and explain this in very, very principled terms and in terms that libertarians and conservatives can understand. So, I mean, I'm hoping that he's going to become something of a public intellectual and use his voice to shore up the institution so that we don't get another autocrat like Donald Trump. But we'll see. I hope he does that.
Well, I guess this gets us to a pretty central question about the liberty movement and libertarians in this moment. I know what you're saying, that libertarians, you know, do exist in this sphere that they hope is both outside of the Democratic and Republican parties. But there have been a lot of moments when libertarians have pushed the GOP to stay true to fiscal conservative ideals, much in the same way that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has served as a foil. Do you think that what exists of the libertarian movement is elastic enough to hold the kind of sway over the Republican Party as it has in the past, or maybe find a new different kind of powerful voice for itself in the national electoral scene?
You know, libertarians have never been all that influential in electoral politics, right? I mean, they just haven't been a force, partly because of the structural barriers towards third parties, and partly, you know, it's not the kind of thing that libertarians generally do well. Their influence has always been through the realm of ideas. You know, I think libertarians, when it comes to fiscal issues and economic issues, they've held strong. I mean, they've never given up on those principles. And they have been the only voice under any president, whether Republican or Democrat, who has consistently called out sort of, you know, the government profligacy and spending and, you know, what have you. So, yeah, I mean, they are going to continue to articulate those arguments. I have no doubt about that. The question is what kind of traction they are going to get. And there I am more pessimistic. I mean, I think, you know, the Democratic side was never took debts and deficits seriously. And Republicans, because of Trump, have lost complete street cred on that issue, too, because he was even more profligate than any of the previous Democratic presidents in recent memory. So their Republican constituency that the libertarians had for those kinds of issues, I don't think credibly exists anymore. And so we will see if Republicans, you know, clean up their act. I think it's going to take a while. It's going to take a whole lot of work for them to be taken seriously again on this issue. You know, they will need to bring back the Paul Ryans of the world who had made spending their signature issue. Right now, I don't see anybody in the Republican Party who's willing to run with that mantle. Until somebody does, libertarians are going to be just sort of crying in the wilderness.
Do you still see a place for yourself within the movement?
Knew you were going to ask me that. I don't know. I mean, you know, in a way, there is a movement and there's no movement, right? I mean, we're all free to do and write what we want to write, and then we will see, you know, how many people are willing to listen. I have lost my my old platform at Reason Magazine, but I'm going to continue to espouse the ideas that I want to. And, you know, you're referring to my recent ouster from Reason. But, you know, the overwhelming response and support I've got from people actually makes me quite, and libertarians actually, makes me quite hopeful that there is some space for my brand of libertarianism going forward. But we'll see.
Shika Dalmia is a columnist at The Week. Thank you so much for talking with us today. And here's hoping for better things in 2021.
Thank you, April.
As we mentioned earlier, Shika Dalmia's long partnership with Reason.com ended forcibly this week. Quoting from her Facebook post, "My views, I was told, had become too out of step with those of the organization." We reached out to Reason for comment. While we haven't heard back directly, Reason editor-in-chief Catherine Mangu Ward told the Daily Beast, "Dalmia's departure from Reason was a personnel issue, so she would not discuss the details." And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening, and have a safe weekend. We'll catch up with you on Monday.